Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 336, I think. Six or seven, who knows. This week's guest is Jack Rook. I've been a fan of Jack for a long while. He's a spoken word artist, comedian, writer. He has a new book out called Cheer the Fuck Up, to be blunt. And then brackets, How to Save Your Best Friend. This was one of my favourite conversations I've had in recent times, particularly over Zoom. It's often tough to feel you get the connection over Zoom, but it was so great to just catch up with Jack. And he talks, he's got a really good way, and I've known this since seeing his spoken word and his comedy and all sorts. He's got a really good way of talking about really heavy, serious subjects and making them feel so light and so positive and comfortable to discuss, which is something that, you know, Distraction Pieces has been known for since the relatively early days, since Eddie Temple Morris and Gail Porter both came on and were so open. It's become almost a trademark of ours. So yeah, it was great to have Jack on. Have a listen. I think you're going to love it, and I think you're then going to want to, in fact, I'd be surprised if you can get more than halfway through without pre-ordering his book, which is out this week. So essentially, if you order it, it will just come immediately. So yeah, support it if you can. Order from a local bookstore. There's a lot of independent bookstores that do deliveries and mail order. There's a lot of local ones who will do that as well. We're at risk of losing a lot of these places in these weird times. So I encourage that. You know, I know it's easier to just go on Amazon and click. And if you need to do that, then you need to do that. But in this period, Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, has just had the biggest increase of wealth of an individual in 24 hours of any human ever. So that's mad. And independent bookstores are closing down. So if you can make that tiny little bit extra effort, order from somewhere else. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast with Jack Rook. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I mean, we're rolling and we've started. I'm joined today by Jack Rook. You're rolling, right?
I'm now recording, but I'm worried that I sound really echoey.
I mean, a little behind the scenes, almost every episode that we recorded of the Beatdown when I was on XFM had us going. For some reason, every time we'd get in the studio, me and the producer would completely forget how to use everything, particularly if there was a guest, and it'd be pure panic, and we would end every interview and then quickly be like, let's check if it's recorded, because we'd just lose all confidence for some reason, despite having loads of experience in it.
But, I loved that show. That has a real throwback to me being in my second year of university and having loads of friends around mine to listen to it, because you played one of my friend Cecilia Knapp's songs. You played, she made music for a little bit, and you played one of those tracks, and we were all like, "Whoa!"
Oh, that's amazing. So exciting. Well, I mean, I'm not sure if we're going to start with the start of this or start from when you started recording again. So I should mention I'm joined here by Jack Rook. We've definitely started at some point. We've started, but yeah, that's amazing. It's been so mad because the Beatdown was such a niche thing. But since then we've kind of found with podcasts, the niche things can often have the most impact on individuals. It might not have the impact on the wider world, but the amount of people I've spoken to who I've become a fan of, who's like, I used to listen to the Beatdown all the time. And again, like when I was doing it, I was well aware that we were doing it at midnight on a Friday or Saturday.
It was like that. But that was the perfect time, because we used to roll in from the pub and listen.
It's perfect. I was always recording with the assumption that no one is listening. But that was part of the reason of doing it at that time. And I got offered, like when I was offered that show, I was offered 10 p.m., 11 p.m. or midnight. and I chose midnight because I wanted to be the most out the way. I didn't want anyone to be able to pick it apart, because I wanted to, particularly on spoken word, I wanted to leave in swear words if necessary, because it's an important part of language. And I felt the earlier we were on, the more we'd get people who were just passing by who might get offended, whereas the later we were on, everyone would be there specifically to listen and understand that that was the context of it all. But yeah, so yeah, Cecilia is someone I met around the same time as you, I guess, because I booked her. I think I booked her the first year I took in a lot of the Roundhouse collective kind of crew. I'm sure it was her.
Do you want me to tell you who was in my gang?
Yeah, who was in your gang?
It was, so, it's like, historically, I think the Roundhouse Poetry Collective, it's quite an interesting, the alumni from it is quite a, like, broad band of people, which I think is so great.
Yeah.
But in my gang, we were maybe, like, year five or six. I think we were, like, the final Polar Bear year, actually, the final year that he tutored it. So it was me, Cecilia Knapp. Another poet called Maria Ferguson.
Yep, I had Maria at Bestival several times as well.
Yeah, she's amazing. Great. And another poet called Jess Green, who you must know as well.
Yeah, I had her a few years later. I missed Jess for some reason on that initial kind of wave of people in there. But yeah, she's fantastic as well.
But it was quite cool because, like, you just sort of... Whoever, it almost became a bit like coming out of drama school. When I speak to people now that went to drama school and they spent, you know, like $30,000 on it, every year they're like, oh yeah, I was in this year with, you know, this guy's in the Crown now, or I was in this year with like whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I was the year that Jess Green did a poem about like Michael Gove. And like, you know, it sort of felt like it was quite an exciting... I always felt like I was totally blagging it. Everybody else was much more of a writer-poet, whereas I just did, like, funny lists and blagged my way through, essentially.
It's one of the things that me and Polar initially connected on. So I guess, for some context, the Roundhouse Collective was, like, a workshop, essentially, that happened at the Roundhouse. It was led by Polar Bear for a long time. I assume it got handed over after he...
Yeah, it went to Bogdan.
Yes. Of course, yeah.
And then it went to Bridget Minimore, who's also another brilliant poet. So,
The thing that me and Polar originally connected on was that neither of us felt like we were what people were calling us. You know what I mean? People were referring to us as writers and poets and stuff like that. And we were like, I'm just getting up and telling some stories. And we felt underqualified because we hadn't gone to... university and study language or could read Latin or anything like this that was kind of a certain area of the spoken word scene was that. And that was, I think, the point of the Roundhouse Collective, was to open it up to people and to tell them, oh no, what you're doing, it isn't just funny lists. It's beautiful. It's art. It's you may think it's throw away because you find it quite easy, but no one else, most people couldn't do that. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of these things, people will often look at athletes and say, well, his genetics allow him to be a basketball player. I could never have been a basketball player. Look at my genetics. But I think that goes across so many different things. Just because you've got that maybe natural advantage, it doesn't diminish it in any way as a skill.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly thought that when I started doing spoken word stuff, it was, 2011, 2012? That was the year that I did that project. And it was also coincided with my first year of going to uni. So I had really no clue what I was doing in either branches of my life, both writing these, like, weird poems and also doing, like, a journalism degree. And I kind of, like, I definitely think that it was so nice to just, like, write stuff. And even if it was shit, I could laugh about it being shit, if that makes sense. I could kind of go, especially now, I look back and I'm like, fucking hell. Like, in the book, I talk about my very first poem that I wrote, which had a line where I rhymed daddy with Maddie McCann. And everybody, I remember doing the Bangs at the Gun Poetry Slam, and one of the, like, it was always that Poetry Slam, a member of the public was the judge.
Yeah.
And this bloke coming up to me and being like, that Madeleine McCann joke was absolute. And I was like, it wasn't a joke. It was definitely not a joke. I'm not, the lowest form of wit is Madeleine McCann jokes. I've not done that. And it was sort of like, they were so bad. The rhymes were absolutely dreadful. But I look back on it with such fondness because it was exactly what you said. It was a completely kind of like equal footing to start writing. Like if you were able to just formulate sentences, that was enough of a qualification to do it. And then you just sort of refined and honed yourself and like figured out what it was that was your particular skill. Like I much preferred just sort of performing and talking and speaking and kind of actually being on the spot rather than writing something in full. And that kind of was like my way into sort of doing more kind of stand-up-y type stuff.
Yeah, or that's what I loved about the Roundhouse, about having the Roundhouse Collective at Best of All on the spoken word stage I used to book, was you were kind of seeing people in still figuring out what they were and who they were.
Yeah.
I'd see Cecilia, for example, and I'd be like, this is amazing, but I think she's a playwright or a scriptwriter rather than necessarily a spoken word artist or whatever. And I'd see you and go, I think Jack's a stand-up. I think he's a stand-up. There's poetry in it. Rob Alton's another perfect example of that. He headlined at on that stage, and he was so nervous because he was like, the headliner the night before was Kate Tempest. And Kate Tempest and Rob Alton's poetry is very, very different. But their control of the crowd is exactly the same. And the warmth and excitement that people get from their performances is exactly the same. So I always remember him, like, again, Rob is one of my proudest moments at Best of All, because he was so convinced it wasn't going to work. And then within, I think, 5 words, I think it was, I knew it was going to be one of the best things that we ever had there. He just came out and started and everyone was so on board. I was like, but you could see it in his face. You could see him go, oh, it's going to be all right. This is going to be a fun hour kind of thing.
He's just like, he's the most like wonderful performer, I think.
Yeah.
Because actually the most exciting thing about him is the uncertainty of kind of being like, oh, how's this going to go? Are people going to get it? And because I hosted Bangs at the Gun for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And Rob would perform like most weeks. And eventually, you know, Rob kind of built up this very much sort of like cult fandom type thing. You could tell the people that were there for Rob Orton, which was great.
Yeah.
But then sometimes if we ever did a gig as a Bangs at the Gun Collective and we weren't in the sort of like safe upstairs at the Roebuck pub, then like where we used to always do the night every week, then you could really, it was a risk who was going to flop and who was going to fly. Sometimes Laurie Bolger would completely fly and Rob Orton would completely flop. And sometimes I would completely, like, it was quite interesting because it really is all about the room and how audiences are sort of willing to, I suppose, like, take on material that's a bit absurd and a bit kind of, like, wacky.
Yeah.
But that's also kind of why I think, that's why I'm almost quite glad that Rob has never gone, oh, I'm just going to be a stand-up comedian. He's kind of kept his fingers in lots of different pies because he is exactly that. He's a bit of everything. He's like a big pizza.
Yeah.
I'm also so glad that his podcast is doing so well.
Amazing. It won the best daily podcast at the British Podcast Awards. But yeah, it's exactly that. I think there's something exciting about those acts where they're different wherever you put them, and that's what makes them exciting. And I think you're one of them. Again, I think your delivery and style suits stand-up perfectly, but you'll talk about some heavy stuff that not all stand-up crowds are going to be going to be up for. And Rob's exactly the same in that. I've talked to him on his highs and his lows over the years on touring, because particularly on the touring, on the headline touring circuit, if people just see, oh, there's some comedy in town tonight, and they go and get Rob Alton, it might not be what they're expecting. But if that might be the biggest surprise and treat of your life, or it might genuinely be your evening ruined and you feeling yeah. like you've wasted your money because he's not TV mainstream a comedy. So, yeah.
He's not going to come on and do, like, loads of dick jokes.
No.
He'll do, like, really artful dick poetry that's yeah. a bit bizarre, but it's never going to be, like, it's never going to be BJ jokes.
And the beautiful thing, again, this is just turning into a podcast about Rob, but the thing I enjoy the most is...
That'll win us an award.
Yeah, yeah. The thing I enjoy the most about watching him is he goes through the show with you as an audience member. He's equally as aware that there's points, like, it could fall off at any point, and he doesn't hide that. He doesn't just go, here's my show, I'm going to stay in, bang, 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 yeah. love it or hate it. He's very aware, you're very aware, you're all, I don't know, it feels like it's such a shared experience. But how did you find that kind of, that period of figuring out what you were on as a performer? Do you know what I mean? Because if you're in a workshop with being taught by Polar Bear, with Cecilia, with Jess, with Maria, all these, then you're going to have a natural thing to lean towards. I always think the first period of people at that time doing the Roundhouse Collective would produce a load of mini Polar Bears.
Oh yeah, we all sounded exactly like him.
And then they would start. The exciting part would be where they go off from that. So how was that finding out? Because it is weird. You get influenced by those around you and those that you're excited and you respect. And
I think I was probably, and I mean, if the girls hear this, then they might be quite annoyed at me. I think I was the one that least sounded like him.
Yeah.
But there was still a certain, like, rhythmic... I mean, his writing's so amazing that you couldn't help but sort of, like, want to emulate the sort of, like, pausing and the sort of, like, form of what he does. But he was very, very... I think he was aware of it, and he was very good at, like, tailoring advice to each one of us as individuals. So Polar Bear would always say to me, what you need to do is write stories. They need to be, like, long, and you need to not just be doing, like, because you can do throwaway jokes quite easily. So if you just write something that's much longer, that really has, like, a beginning, middle and end, and then you pepper them in, that's going to really grab people. Yeah. And I, like, quite arrogantly, I mean, I hosted Banks of the Gun for about 2 years, and then I had, like, a good maybe, like, 10-minute set of, like, bits of comedy storytelling and little, like, list poems. And then I just jumped straight to writing an hour-long show for Edinburgh because I, A, got Arts Council funding. I can't really be like, it was this amazing creative idea. I got money to do it. Yeah. And B, because I think he was exactly right. Like, I sort of had so much to say that I would either say sort of nothing at all or everything in, like, 3 minutes.
Yeah.
So actually to have a whole hour-long show is kind of, like, definitely the making of me as a writer-performer, because it allowed me to properly tell a story from lots of different angles and to bring, like, six different, like, narratives into one thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he was just so good at kind of knowing how each one of us could develop more. And that's sort of what you want. I still say, and I think I say it in the book, like, he's the best teacher I've ever had. Even though he wasn't, like, you could never quite make him, like, your best mate. Like, you sort of could, like, your drama teacher at school. I was so used to being, like, teacher's pet at school. Like, drama teachers would be like, oh, we'll get Jack to, like, put on a dress. Or, like, the English, like, I could kind of charm them. Whereas with him, he was very much like, all right. And you were like, oh, okay, you're gonna really, really, you can't just sort of, like, charm your pants off type thing. You actually have to do the work and do the writing and not turn up, like, 20 minutes late with a hangover. Because the workshop was on a Sunday morning, which at, like, 10 a.m., which when you're in your first year of uni was quite a difficult commitment to keep up. So I would often just walk in at, like, 10:30, having, like, commuted all the way from, like, Harrow or whatever on, like, three rail replacement buses because it was a Sunday, and then just be like, I've written this poem, it's about my dad, he's dead, is this all right? And he'd be like, you're 45 minutes late, read your poem. And it was sort of like, I just used to write all my bits on the rail replacement bus going there, which I thought was kind of like now I look at it as like the most ironic thing that I was writing it on the bus, like homework. Yeah. But then I really, it was so exciting to actually like, I mean, it kind of became a bit like group therapy in many ways, because it was sort of like all of us as young writers from different places around the UK actually coming to this like venue, which, you know, the Roundhouse obviously has had everyone from like, I mean, it literally had like Britney Spears 3 years ago to, you know, like Megadeth. And so there would always be like queues of fans outside for like whatever band or act was on. And then we'd sort of just like push past them and then sit in this windowless room and just like share all of our trauma for 6 hours and then go and get a kebab after. Like it was, and it was also like free. It cost like a tenner for a year, which was amazing.
The process of that is a really kind of a stumbled upon bit of genius, I think, of writing on the bus on the way there. Because when you've got that kind of time limit and you're false, you don't have time to second guess yourself. And often, particularly with spoken word, you'll go, I need to put something emotional in there. So you'll open up about stuff that you might have shielded a bit more. I always remember talking to Sage Francis and one of his songs, The Best of Times, that's seen as his most open and emotional. He'd got the chance to work with a producer he'd always wanted to work with, and there was one day it was going to happen. So he literally travelled there. On the way there, he wrote this piece, performed it, recorded it, and it's up there as either his most iconic song or one of his most iconic songs. But I think it's because it had to be that, right, I need to just, I can't hide things. I think poets are really good hiding things in plain sight. Something can seem really open and honest, and really you've wrapped it in so many things that no one can really see it, so you don't have to actually feel exposed. Whereas you don't have time to do that on the rail replacement bus on a Sunday morning.
Oh, 100%. I always remember I made a documentary about 2 years ago about the rapper MIA, who I've always been a long-term fan of. Yeah. A very sort of bizarre, like, I think most gay men have got, like, one kind of female pop star that they, like, grown up loving. And mine was never, like, Gaga or Britney or Madonna. It was always just, like, her, because she was such a sort of strange but, like, amazing character. And I still, you know, she's a wild ride of a person. But I do remember when I was interviewing, I interviewed her at Bestival 2018. Actually, what I would like to think of it as the last ever interview that ever happened at Bestival, because she headlined like the final night. And I was like, and then we did the interview backstage and I was speaking to her about stuff. And she at one point told me that when she wrote Paper Planes, she just woke up one morning. She recorded it in the morning. She hadn't even brushed her teeth. So, and she just like wrote it on the fly. She was just like, na, 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 na. And I was like, and then she just recorded it. And the first vocal that you hear in the song is the first take. It was just, that was it. Amazing. She was like, my teeth were grimy. It was sort of a bit gross. And I was a bit like, that probably, I mean, that song, to me, I'm still like, it's one of the greatest songs of all time. I think it's, and I remember you did I can't remember, maybe it was like a mixtape you did, like, you did like a version of it, because Straight to Hell by The Clash, when I was a kid, weirdly, was like one of my favourite songs. My dad loved The Clash. And I sort of like, I can remember dancing to it at like 4 and having no clue of it being this like incredible kind of poem about immigration and like America. And like,
the best Christmas song. It's a Christmas song. It's a deep Christmas song about immigration and exploitation. But yeah, I did kind of a version of it when we were launching my club night. So I did an extended remix that brought the Clash bit in and then wrote, I can't even remember what I wrote, just some nonsense to go over the top of it. And it was classic.
It was strange because I think Paper Planes as a song, and this is what Maya was saying, she was like, it's weird writing a song that's essentially about immigration and basically took inspiration from the song it had sampled from. It almost felt like a kind of like Straight to Hell 2.0 type thing.
Yeah.
But have like loads of kids dancing to it at their sweet 16 birthday party without any clue about what the lyrics were about.
And yeah,
those are white kids just like that.
Yeah.
And but I was a bit like, I think I started that because I was like 5 dancing to Straight to Hell, not having a single clue what it was. There's just something about that beat, I think.
I think my favourite example of that to this day is Sound of the Police by KRS-One.
Yeah.
That is an intricate piece about the plantations and the evolution of police coming off the back of slavery.
Yeah.
Yet in a club, whoop, whoop, that's all it is. It's whoop, whoop. And it's like, you're dancing to this really powerful song, but it's just whoop, whoop.
It's the one song that's always used in like a really shit BBC Three urban sitcom as well. It's like what white people think is like the hood. It's just like everyone like, yeah. But that's sort of it, isn't it? I suppose once you've put out something, you can't control how it's taken. You know, you can't really control the parameters of how either successful or not. I mean, I think it's the same about Lil Nas X now.
Yeah.
I think he's amazing. Just because I'm like, how fucking great that you just were like, I really want to do this and I'm just going to put this out and it just like flies like that. Like,
I agree. Yeah. So is you spoke about Polar Bear pushing you to write long stories with a beginning, middle and an end. And obviously as this podcast comes out, your book comes out in a couple of days. Cheer the Fuck Up, How to Save Your Best Friend. How was it writing a book? I guess part of it came off the back of getting that Edinburgh show that you explored a deeper, longer subject.
Was
that kind of part of the journey?
I do not particularly think that I have written the book in a way that I would have... If I was writing about something completely, I would almost love to write a book about a completely new topic. Yeah. I think because I was writing something where I had like 3 Edinburgh shows worth of material to take from and silly poems that I'd done and like diary entries from when I was like 15. Because my dad died when I was 15, 2008. Yeah. And I pretty much, the month after he died, my mum, which is probably like the maybe actually was like the best thing that ever happened to me. My mum was like, okay, we've got some money left over from his funeral and I want to buy you a laptop. I just want to get you your own thing so you're not just using this like crap computer that we had. And I was like, okay. And I found on Comet, if you remember Comet, the old electricals giant, I found a refurbished MacBook and I was like, I want a white MacBook. I just want to be one of those people that's got a posh laptop. So I got this white MacBook and it was like that I put all of my grief. Oh, I just popped on the peas there. I got this white MacBook. I put all of my grief into whatever that MacBook could do. So whether it was just like writing pages upon pages upon pages or making terrible GarageBand song after terrible GarageBand song, writing really sort of like quite crap lyrics that I thought, oh, maybe these will be poems. Like, I just sort of put all of those experiences of loss and the way I articulated it into this machine and then was like, one day I'm going to do something with this. And I've weirdly like kept that MacBook in as good condition as I possibly could because I was just like, there's so much stuff on here that was just all of my thoughts from like basically September 2008 till like I went to uni like September 2011.
Wow. Yeah.
And it's a really interesting thing to look back on, which I did for the book, because I sort of noticed how I just stopped being a child. Like it was almost quite depressing rereading it because I felt really sorry for 15-year-old me because I was just like, God, like you're... I kind of hadn't really... I think the human mind and the memory is amazing at like kind of wiping down trauma slightly. It kind of like scrubs it up a little bit so that you're not just constantly in like the jagged edges of it.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to sort of go back and go, Christ, like... I was a 15-year-old kid who just turned 15, who was worried about, like, losing our house and was worried about, you know, what my mum was going to do and was worried, like, about, you know, a big thing that I kind of had forgotten was that, like, I had always known that I was gay, I think. I was pretty sure. I was like, okay, I am, but I just completely, when your dad dies at 15, it's like, oh, being gay is the least of my worries. Like, I kind of deleted it. I, like, didn't really have that kind of puberty moment where I got to, like, 16, 17. Like, it came to me much later. I think I always knew, and, I mean, I must have always known because, like, you know, I wrote, like, horny pages about how much I fancied Eric Cantona. Like, you know, you don't fancy Eric Cantona and not be gay.
Yeah.
But, although, I think we all fancy Eric Cantona a little bit.
Yeah, it's quite fair.
But,
it's the collar.
Yeah.
It was the collar. It was just, there was a certain,
Cantona's
he could be
collar.
Manly and effeminate at the same time. Somebody.
Yeah.
Glorious thing.
But yeah, so it was, you know, going back over that stuff was quite interesting because it actually really helped me understand a lot of my negative qualities now, if that makes sense, because I can sort of see where the seeds were sown, so to speak. Actually, writing the book, weirdly, has probably been one of the best experiences exactly for those reasons, because it's allowed me to sort of retrospectively kind of analyze myself in a weird way.
Yeah.
But then it's also been really hard because, like, writing a book's fucking bollocks. I don't know why anyone does it. It's so hard. Right. It goes on forever. And, and it's like, yeah, it's just so it's a kind of mix. But I'm proud of the kind of the range of the sort of stories and the ground that it covers.
Yeah.
And
because it's part kind of comedic memoir, obviously with heavy stuff in there, but also part guide to tips on how to cope with certain things and stuff like that. Right.
And I think I kind of wanted it to have a bit more of a practical element because, you know, when I was back in those sort of that first day of uni, that first year of uni, when I was doing the Roundhouse Poetry Collective, at the same time, I also started volunteering for Calm, which as a charity back then, Campaign Against Living Miserably, you know, they've grown so much. I mean, they're huge now, but they really weren't back then. I think actually you were one of the first sort of real like ambassadors of them.
Yeah.
Like speaking about them as a service and as their magazine.
I working with them when it was just Jane and one other person. And again, it's kind of, it ties into your book and your story. The reason I started working with them was because years before, a dear friend of mine had taken his own life on his 21st birthday. So I kind of experienced that. And you've had a very similar kind of experience in your life, right?
Yeah. I mean, what was quite strange to me is that, so my friend Ollie, I met at university and we bonded over, I have this in the book, the first chat we ever actually had, the first friendly chat we ever had was about you. Because he was such a big fan of yours.
It was such a mad...
That kind of whole era of just like listening to the beat down and like that kind of thing, it really sort of encapsulates those years for me of like me and him. And he was very different to me. So I met Ollie, he was in his second year, I was in my first year. We were both studying journalism. And he was your like seaside town lad's lad. He was 5 years older than me. He kind of thought he was a bit of a geese. He like, you know, he was always a hit with the ladies and was very much this character who I thought, this is somebody much more confident than I am. This is somebody who's got, you know, chutzpah, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then the more I got to know him, and the reason I got to know him is because he was working at the student radio station, and I was like, oh, maybe that's something I kind of want to do. And we kind of struck up a weird friendship because he had found out I was doing this poetry course, and he was like a huge hip-hop fan, loved poetry, loved writing, but it was something that he very much did separately, quietly, just for himself, just for his own, like, catharsis. And our friendship was mainly kind of like me encouraging him to perform and to write more and to kind of be more confident about that stuff, because it was only in that stuff that I knew about his mental health difficulties, that I knew that, you know, he was sort of bipolar and then misdiagnosed borderline personality disorder. Like, he was constantly trying to define what this other thing in his life was. Yeah. And I in my mind, I was a bit like poetry and writing had massively helped me to process losing my dad. Like, it was, it really, really, I mean, I'm sort of conscious in the book that I don't, I'm slightly worried because I sort of, there's parts of the spoken word world that I kind of gently slag off because it, that, you know, there's sort of annoying stereotypes within
and,
it.
And but, another thing that me and Polar Bear bonded over was
slagging off spoken word.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I won't go into too much detail, but whenever me and Polar Bear would meet up for a drink, and sometimes me, Polar, and Kate Tempest, the first hour or so would be what's currently annoying us in the spoken word scene, yeah. And then we'd get on to actually having a nice conversation.
I mean, it had its flaws, definitely. But at the same time, like, it completely put me on a different path that I would not have been on as a human being, or as just a young person that had gone through a lot of traumatic stuff and still had a lot of traumatic stuff to come, so to speak. Yeah. And so, you know, Ollie, I used to take to Bangs of the Gun, and I used to take him to the open mic nights, and I maybe took him like 6 or 7 times, and it was like the 8th time that I was like, you have to sign up. You just have to do it. Even if you're reading it from your phone, just who gives a shit? Just do it, because it will give you something. Even if you don't like it, it will give you that chance to like share it. Yeah. And so he signed up, and then he would drop out or he would go missing. And then it got to like maybe like the 18th time, and I was like, you're doing it. I'm locking the door. I'm hosting. You're on the list. I'm calling you up. I'm making you the Hatterlist, even, which was like the hype girl for Bangs of the Gun.
Yeah.
And he performed. And I mean, he did it like shoulders like up, shaking, holding his phone. And he was amazing. But it was the most nervous performance you've ever seen, and he like won the slam, and the judge was completely somebody random, and like it was so brilliant to like see him just use like writing as this almost like this sideline to him being this sort of like cheeky chappy lad.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I find it sort of, it's very strange to me to talk about, because, you know, I also involved Ollie in lots of Calm stuff that I did. Like, we did a Calm fundraiser together. We did, like, gigs. He knew about Calm. We had the free Calm zine magazine at our uni, and we'd read it. And, like, you know, he was very aware of those services. And I think what I've particularly found, especially with a lot of the narratives around mental health and young men, is this sort of, this kind of thing of, we never knew how bad he was. We never knew. He didn't know how to get help. He, like, there's this kind of like idea of it's always a kind of a secret that's been kept.
Yeah.
And that obviously is very valid in quite a lot of cases, which is sad. And but in mine, it was like, oh no, we've spoken about this. We have addressed it head on. I am not fully aware of his history, but I know enough to know that I need to keep an eye on him and check in with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of very difficult then. And I mean, I sort of, in the book, it's sort of very strange to reread over, because it's such a bizarre story. It's very strange, like you kind of couldn't, it's one of those weird things in life where you're like, oh, you just couldn't write this and it be believable. But
yeah.
I had just graduated from uni. Ollie had graduated the year before. And there was maybe this just 1 year period where he was kind of struggling. He was like in that newly graduated, trying to get a job in the media whilst also being like working class and having no fucking contacts whatsoever. Yeah. And he got little jobs here and there, and he was doing all right. And then he would just sort of go on a bit of a slump. And then it was like, I can't really afford to stay in London. And then it was like, I can't really afford to be doing like journalism, music journalism type stuff. And so he moved back home, back to sort of Bognor, Chichester area. And I, meanwhile, was also skint and had just like graduated and was living in this like mad property guardianship in Hampstead Heath, like literally on the heath with like 14 other people. It was just like the most mad kind of weird, chaotic experience. And I was like, I'm going to write a show and take it to Edinburgh because I've managed to get this Arts Council money. And I had pitched the show to lots of different producers, as you do for Edinburgh, and hadn't really heard back because I'd done like a bit of hosting, but I wasn't like an established act by any means.
Right, yeah.
And then I did the final pitch About 2 weeks before my final pitch, I spoke to Ollie, and it was the first time I'd spoken to him in a long time. And I could hear in his voice that he wasn't great. And I also wasn't great. We were both sort of in a bit of a bad place. But we made all these plans that we would meet up and he'd come up to London and he could come and stay with me and we'd do some stuff. And, you know, I think when you graduate uni and people move away, that kind of trying to keep in contact becomes just naturally harder anyway. And then I had this pitch for a venue called Underbelly, and it was at the beginning of March 2015 or whatever. And I, that morning before, I had gone to Calm to do a bit of volunteering and B, to like print out, basically use Calm's printers, like, just sort of like mug them of stationery, so I could print out my pitch and proposal to give it to the producers, because it was my last chance to get into the festival. Yeah. And so I left Calm and I went to Underbelly. And as I was on my way, I kept on getting a missed call from my friend Claire, who was mine and Ollie's sort of mutual great good pal. And I kind of was like, I just instantly knew. And I can't really explain. It was like, I just thought, she's missed called me three times. He's not here anymore. And that was just all that could come into my head. Yeah. And so I was walking out of the tube on my way to this big pitch where I'd like printed off a budget I didn't know how to explain and all this shit. And it was a show that was essentially about my dad dying, and me and my nan kind of co-wrote it. And it was sort of about that experience of losing him. And I called my mum and I was like, I'm about to do this pitch. And I think my friend Claire is about to tell me that my friend Ollie has taken his own life. And my mum was like, well, that would be absolutely bonkers, wouldn't it? She, bless her, I feel so sorry for my mum. It's quite dark laughing about it. But she completely talked me out of thinking that, which thank God she did, because I would have gone into the pitch with that like anxiety. And she was like, you're being stupid. Good luck. And so I went in to do this pitch with the producers and I was explaining the show and what I kind of wanted to do in Edinburgh. And I just kept on getting the missed call throughout the pitch. And I was like, okay, whatever it is, even if it's not as bad as that, it's something bad. Mm. And so I finished the pitch. I was at Underbelly's office. I went downstairs and I called Claire. And that's when she told me. And it was this very strange sort of feeling of being like, oh, wow, he's actually sort of done it. I kind of never really believed that he would. Yeah. And I guess it's because, A, you never hope that anyone would, but I hadn't really clocked that things had got that bad, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then I couldn't really do much with myself because I was sort of in this office. And then one of the producers came down and I'd known one of my friends, Dan, had worked at Underbelly, and I'd sort of explained what had happened. And then one of the producers came down and she was just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I was like, yeah, I kind of don't really quite know what to do with myself. And she was like, well, the only thing I can say is you smashed the pitch. Like, we've given you a show. You've got a slot. It's like at 4 PM. It's in our smallest venue, but we'll help you financially with the show. We'll take it on. Like, don't worry about it. We want to do it. Yeah. And so it's this very bizarre day of getting the worst news and the best news in about the same 15-minute time period. And like, I sort of think that it's always kind of been a very sort of strange, sort of, I don't know if the word's like serendipitous, or sort of very much felt like I kind of had to use that opportunity. I kind of got given a blow and an opportunity at the same time. Yeah. And I needed to use the opportunity to help me deal with the other thing.
Yeah.
And like, it made it very hard for a while to kind of help Calm, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sort of made it very hard to kind of talk about the suicide or talk about, you know, how to help someone, because I just was a bit like, I felt like as a Calm ambassador for a male suicide prevention charity, to lose a close friend to male suicide, I felt a little bit like, we slightly fucked it there, Jack. I kind of took on the blame and the guilt, because I thought, oh my God, if there was anybody you could come to, it would be me.
Yeah.
And obviously,
again, it's also in those things, it's so easy to give advice. Like, you know what you would have said to someone else in that situation, but you couldn't take that. You would have let them know they did all they could, there's sometimes you just can't do it. You can only do a certain amount. Yet that doesn't help telling yourself that. Because you're like, no, fuck that. I should have done better than that. But
yeah,
it's fascinating. You've, in both those kind of traumatic events, you talked about going back over the laptop and looking at you kind of logging the period after your dad died. And similar with this is, it's really interesting. It's something I've been looking into a lot recently for something I'm writing, but we remember in highlights and we forget everything that was in between that. And it's really, even more so as people have written about any traumatic events, it becomes this even more specific fictional version of a highlight because you've got this piece about it.
Here's how
it was when dad died. Here's how it was when this happened.
Yeah.
And you're not actually in the reality of it. And the thing with, as you said, the quite common but seemingly unusual event of someone taking their lives when it's not out of nowhere is that you forget that, because I've been in situations before where there's someone who seems to be constantly on the edge of taking their lives. And it's easy to forget that that becomes normal, and it has to. There's a level of it that becomes normal and regular life. It's not this every time it's on the edge that it's drop everything. And it's not that you don't think it's going to happen. It's just anything that is regular, there becomes a normality to it. I was lucky that the person I had it with didn't end up taking their lives. So that kind of, it figured itself out and so on and so forth. But when it doesn't go that way, it's easy to think of the one time it didn't go that way rather than all the other times that you were there and you may have made the difference, or it may have gone that way if you hadn't done this or this and that. All you can think about is the one time it did go that way and you either didn't do this or you did do this, but maybe it wasn't enough, or you could have done, and all these other thoughts. And that can be, I don't know, that becomes the highlight that we remember rather than the grander period where this was going on and we did so much and we helped so much and took on so much. And as you'd give advice to anyone else, there's only so much that you can do in these things.
I think you're totally right. I think suicide feels very much like a kind of failure of everything. Mm-hmm. So it completely wipes. It's like a kind of control alt delete type thing. It kind of just, anything that you've done beforehand is kind of gone, because you're like, well, the end goal was to prevent this. So it makes you feel like, it makes you feel like a failure. It makes you feel like there's a failure in everything. It makes you feel like there's a failure of the services there to try and protect those people. It feels like a failure of the love and the bond that you have for that person. It feels like a failure of, you know, yourself and how you can, you know, be, you know, how can you ever be a friend to anybody ever again? I used to ask myself those mad questions because I was like, oh. But then, and there was definitely a period of time where I was like, I can't really help anyone, if that makes sense. And then I actually think what I have come to now is a place where I'm a bit like, oh, okay, I've learned so much from that guilt and from feeling that shame. And I now know that that guilt was just a part of it. It was not actually valid, you know, like there's nothing that you really can do. And I think it's a very sort of, it's something that once you eventually reconcile with, if you ever do, then you can kind of, I almost now feel more confident than I did before Ollie died. I almost feel a bit more like, okay, I'm less scared I'm less scared of getting it wrong. I think that's a big thing that a lot of people have that I've spoken to through Calm, is that fear of saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing. And that fear is the worst thing about it. The fear is worse than actually doing something wrong. If you say something wrong, you can rectify it or learn from it. Whereas if the fear stops you from doing anything, then you've just not done anything. Does that make, like, and I think completely. That fear is the worst thing. And I suppose my gripe, my sort of issue with the kind of mental health conversation or the landscape that it's in right now, or has at least been for the last 4 or 5 years, is that there's so much focus on getting people to talk and getting people to open up, and there's this kind of like big clarion call and like Lloyd's TSB adverts and ITV doing campaigns, and all this stuff is great, but I'm a bit like, if you cannot make people open up and then not equip the other people, like the people like me, the friends, the family, with the tools to deal with that and to deal with those admissions and to deal with the any personal guilt and shame that might come from it, but to also deal with properly supporting and helping someone. And that's where I feel like there has been a bit of a gap in that conversation. That in my mind is how I reconcile writing a book, because I personally feel like me at 26 writing a memoir is the most self-indulgent fucking pricky wanky thing to do. The only way I go, okay, it's an all right thing to have done, is because I'm like, I at least know some of those tips now. I at least know some of those ways of getting over that fear that I'm quite happy to hopefully share with people to help get rid of that fear. Because it's kind of why the book's called Cheer the Fuck Up. I really kind of didn't like that title at the beginning, and then I sort of loved it, because I was a bit like, for me, I have said that to both people and myself at times, and that's very much a line that people view as this incredibly insensitive thing to say, which I agree in some contexts it is, but it's also the thing that you say out of just complete like frustration and despair and love, and like like you're just like, please, like I've when you reach that point, that's when I'm a bit like, you need someone to kind of help you. And I don't think that we have, in the mental health conversation so far, helped the people helping others, if that makes sense.
I think it's a problem of so many of the best things that have happened in recent years, so many of the best causes of movements, to get them to where they are, that they need the sloganisation and memification of nuanced and complex subjects. To get them across to the masses, they need that, but they also need a whole lot more. One that I've been annoyed with for ages is the, it's okay to not feel okay. And that's, it's pushed around a lot, and it's great, but it's like, well, we need a bit more context for that, because that could be read as, oh, I'm just a bit down, it's fine, I'll let it pass. We should be encouraging people to strive to get help. It is okay to not feel okay, but here's what you can do about it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That does,
because actually,
that isn't,
it's not okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's my kind of angle on it, is it's not okay to not feel okay, because you deserve to feel okay.
Yeah.
It shouldn't just be, oh, well, you know, it's fine. It's such a weird one, because it's the intent I completely agree with, because it shouldn't make you feel like you're broken or there's something wrong with you. Everyone has these periods, but we should be striving to encourage people to get help in the right way, to get encouragement in the right way, rather than to go, ah, it's okay to not feel okay.
Yeah.
You know? And again, it's a weird one, because I do think that's such a positive message that's spread about, but now we've got to a point where we need to take it that step further. I guess that's the point with Black Lives Matter and defund the police and mental health and all these things. We need these initial tools to get them to the masses.
Yeah.
But that shouldn't be where it ends. That shouldn't be, well, we got our little slogan out there. On to the
completely.
Next thing. Mental health's sorted now. Everyone knows about it.
And we've done
it. It was a really, again, like the idea of remembering in highlights, it was a really eye-opening thing to read your a section in the book that mentioned me, because you sent it through, because it mentioned me talking about mental health. And I'd kind of forgotten that there was a time where it wasn't talked about. And it wasn't as out there and open. And that was something that made me go, oh, shit, yeah. In my mind, well, you know, it's the thing now. Everyone talks about mental health.
Yeah.
But at least when I was writing those things and talking in schools or whatever else every now and then, it wasn't as openly out there. And so we're definitely in a better place.
Yeah,
100%. Because it is talked about so much more. But as
I mean, the thing that you said, I'll tell the listeners, was there was this very clever thing. I think it was you and. Oh, it was, you were chatting to someone. I think they're from a band, and the name I can't remember, but they were called Itch. What's the band?
Itch,
what am I thinking?
Yeah, from King Blues.
That was it, King Blues. And you were in conversation with him, I think maybe for Calm, and you said, like, you have to treat your mind like a gym. Yeah. Like, there needs to be a gym where you work things out, where you write things down, where you draw things out. Like, you have to use your mental health in that same way.
Yeah.
And, like, that was, like, 2011, 2012, and that really was... I've heard that sentiment in different incarnations since then, but, like, that was the first time I'd heard it in that way. And that was the first time, I think, for me and Cecilia... Knapp, we were like, oh yeah, you know, we really have to try and encourage creativity because it's helped us so much, and hopefully that helps other people. And it doesn't matter if it's shit, like, you know, really, that's kind of why I put the worst poem I've ever written in the book, because I'm like, look how shit this poem is and how shit most grief poetry is.
The beautiful irony of that being the line that I used that got through to you as well is, I bet both of us at that point had never been in a gym. I know I certainly hadn't.
No.
So we're saying we need to prioritise it in the same way as we prioritise our physical health. I wasn't prioritising either. So the irony of that being the thing that got through to us both, and the fact that I was saying that as if I'm some gym guy that's always down there.
Yeah. Also the irony of doing the Roundhouse Poetry Collective, but there being like North London's most famous kebab shop opposite it, and I was literally going every week. And for every week for a year, I ate a halloumi wrap, and I swear I convinced myself halloumi was a vegetable. I was like, this must be good for you, right?
At that period, it was an ongoing joke with Dan and with people in my family that I pretty much exclusively ate pizza as my diet. That all of the if I was eating vegetables, it was on pizza. If I was eating meat, it was on pizza. That was literally all I was eating. I mean, we're getting towards the hour mark, and there's loads more I want to talk about. Because, you've touched upon things that you give advice on in the book, and there's things like how to spot early signs of mental health issues, how to support a friend who's lost someone very close to them, how to help a friend on a painful anniversary, and the bullshit you shouldn't say to a bereaved person on the day of a funeral, which, again... all of these are really key things, and it's really, as you kind of touched upon earlier, we're scared to talk about any of them.
Yeah.
We're often too scared to say anything rather than to look into what we should say or learn what we should say. It's a weird one for me, because on the anniversary thing, the anniversary of my mate Jamie's death turned from being the worst day to being my favourite day of the year, and I've talked about it loads because... it's the day that it feels like he's still here, because all of our mates are posting about him and talking about him. Normally, me and a couple of mates will go round to his mum and dad's and have a barbecue with his brother. And this year we did it over Zoom because we were in lockdown.
Oh, yeah.
And genuinely, it's this beautiful... to me, it's become a celebration. But even then, I have to remind myself that it might not be for his parents... or for my other mates. It's that weird thing of knowing how to broach it and how to discuss it. Because I talk about it all the time. Honestly, it's my favourite day of the year. I can't wait for it. It's beautiful. I think about Jay a lot, but it's the one day where he's at the forefront of all our conversations. And even if I'm hearing the same story off his dad again and the same story off his brother again or whoever else, I'm getting to hear them, and it's great.
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of deciding your key bits of advice, I guess, in these situations?
I think it's... I mean, that summed up is kind of exactly it. I think my mum is probably my... the book's dedicated to my mum because I'm like... it would be very easy to dedicate it to all the dead people in my life, but I'm a bit like, she's weathered every storm with me type thing.
Yeah.
And she's still lost the love of her life, and she's still gone through it all, and yet she's still like, you know... I don't know how she did it. I honestly don't know how you have a teenage son that's just turned 15 who is best mates with his dad as well, because me and my dad were incredibly close, and still just like get chicken nuggets and peas and chips on the table at like 6 o'clock every night. Yeah. Like, it's amazing. And she, for me, is just like the perfect person of trying to take adversity and make it something that has worth and make it so, like, she, I could say this to her in that way and she'd be like, oh, fuck off. I'm just living life, innit? She'd just be like, oh, fuck, like, don't flower it up. But it's exactly what she's done. She's just like turned everything bad and figured out a way of creating some sort of a valuable lesson in it. And I think for me, that's kind of what the advice and the tips are. I mean, I state quite early on in the book, I'm not a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist, and I'm really not trained. Mm. I think I have a different perspective because I'm somebody who's A, lived through it, and then B, have like volunteered with this charity since its very beginning, sort of, you know, inception. And I've watched, I have been that 18-year-old kid to 26-year-old man who has grown up in that mental health conversation evolving and changing. And at times I've been a very shit poster child for it. And at times I've been very critical of it. And at times I've been affected by it. And then I've clocked out as well. So I feel like I'm coming at it from lots of different angles. And the advice stuff for me is just like eradicating that fear and allowing people to think about, I suppose, not even necessarily that the positives, but allowing people to kind of, you know, take what they... So I suppose it's kind of like a pick and choose, like, what is actually going to help you? What are these? There's options, basically. When you go through something traumatic, you think there are no options here. It's very easy to go, I'm just going to fucking smoke 20 joints and stay in bed every week and not, like, it's very, there's almost like two paths you can go down. And in my mind, like, there's so many, like, but it's all about trial and error. And for me, that is mental health encapsulated in one. And I wish that was more of a kind of part of a more nuanced conversation about mental health, is that so much of it is trying a medication and that medication makes you worse and you have to try again. So much of it is finding a therapist who you sit down with and you go, I actually think you're a bit of a cunt. I just say about you, I don't want to listen to. And you might have to try another therapist. And if you're on the NHS, that's fucking hard because it's a bit like
so much of a quick fix society. That mental health now being at the forefront, it doesn't fit into that. We don't have a here's the simple answer. It is, and again, I for a long time was very anti medicating mental health, partly because my mate Jay, I think the drugs sent him in the wrong direction.
That's exactly the same with me. I was really skeptical about it.
Over time, I've learned that the right drugs for the right people, it's as dangerous to dismiss them blindly as it is to say, just give everyone this drug and it will make them better. It is, it's 100% in that way.
Completely. I mean, there's some things that lithium do for people that are like life-saving, and there's some things that it does where it just poisons your whole system. So like it's one of those things, because it's still such a difficult period. It's such a difficult topic scientifically still. It's like, but I do think that needs to be, people need to feel like they have options in life anyway, full stop. Like, that for me is privilege. You have privilege in life if you have options of A, like, just getting out of trouble, or B, getting out of a hard time. Like, if you have options, that's it. And it's the people that don't have options that take those darkest of routes. And that's sort of what I hope the advice guides do. And also, like, I really... You know, there have obviously been some very, very successful books on mental health that have come out in the last 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. And they're all great. But, like, my phone's ringing. Let me turn it off. I apologise. It's my mum.
It's all right. As long as it's not Claire.
It's not Claire. Oh, God, no. Well, actually, if it is Claire, do give me a call sometime. It would be nice to see how you are. Yeah, I mean, Oh, what track of thought was I on? I completely got distracted there.
I mean, to take it in the direction my mind instantly went, mental health has become an industry now, and there's a lot of books on mental health that are very successful, and again, not wanting to slag anything off, but it's like anything, it's become its own industry.
Yeah,
I guess
that's sort of what I've put at the very, very start in the sort of introduction to the book. I've tried to sort of say, like, there's no There's no, like, illustrations of, like, sad clouds or happy clouds or, like, photos, like, stock image photography of people with their head in their hands. Like,
yeah.
It's, and I'm not going to be, there's no inspirational quotes in bold. I'm not here to kind of be a guru or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because that shit does fucking sell thousands of books.
Yeah.
But what it also does is completely strips the nuance that you and me have just discussed.
Yeah.
It strips away the practicalities of actually having to deal with it.
And an inspirational... Again, it's the sloganisation and memification of, yeah, of a really serious subject.
And I get that that's a good entry point in, but when you have literally, like, stood at the grave of a 27-year-old who should still be here, I don't give a fucking shit about, like, reasons to be... like, still here. I want, like, tips to stop this happening. Like, I don't want it to feel like a gift shop. Mental health, I think, does go into that, like, you could just put an inspirational quote on a tea coaster and that's going to keep you alive. And I'm like, no, like, reforming the systems of how people access help and waiting lists and making sure people understand the differences between CBT and then, like, other types of psychotherapy. Like, it's options. It's informing people. And it's not, I don't know. I I never really want to be unkind about anybody ever articulating their own experiences because it's all valid. But I did want this book to sort of slightly stand out as a much more, like, kind of honest, direct, but also, like, funny. I really hope it's funny.
Yeah.
I kind of really wanted it to be, like, as comedic as possible. And it's difficult because arrogant me would love to just write a book of, like, silly cultural essays about being a gay millennial. And then I know that it would get printed and put in my hands and I'd just, like, be like, fuck this, burn this now. Like,
what have I done?
What use is this to anyone?
Your story and your journey of personal experience and of working with Calm for so long, so seeing all of the different options of help, whether they be therapeutical, conversational or medical, just makes me love the name of the book even more because you've also seen your mum just go, just cheer the fuck up. Just, you know what I mean?
The
beauty of that is all the nuances in there. But equally, some people it is as simple as that. And again, it's okay to accept both sides of that. To say it could just be actively telling yourself to cheer the fuck up. It might not be. Here's loads of other options. But it might be as simple as that, which seems crazy, but...
Oh, yeah. 100%. That's the best thing my mum's ever... I mean, I haven't actually put that in the book, weirdly. I took it out, but my mum told me to cheer the fuck up when I was making this rather depressing BBC Three documentary, and I was just absolutely hating it and having a terrible time. And my mum was just like, oh, cheer the fuck up. Like, just enjoy it. So what if it's a bit shit? Like, so what if you don't like it? Like, just try and take... She's just so good. And the issue is she's not a cheer the fuck up, let's put a plaster over things that are shit. She's like, no, give me the shit. I unload the shit and talk about the hard stuff. But then also, like, you know, I guess there's one thing that I kind of end the book on, and it is this like feeling of like there's always going to be miserable people. There's always going to be a certain amount of misery. Like, Calm, in my mind, I just loved the title at the beginning of it when I, like, campaign against living miserably, because I'm like, that is a certainty. There's always going to be a miserable time. But in my mind, like, and this has kind of been the difficult thing I think about recent times in lockdown, there's so much of what I say in the book is about just changing the use of, like, saying me and just changing it to we, like finding other people, making it a kind of communal thing of, like, actually, I don't know, like, taking your... Sometimes it's so easy, or I've definitely found it, it's so easy to just be like, woe is me. Why is my life like this? Why am I bloody... Yeah, again, I've even got a contempt of being gay. You could just sort of, like, do the kind of, like, you know, sad Olympics for yourself. But then actually I'm like, there's so many different people going through similar stuff, and and it's the one thing that, like, frees up generations, it frees up gender, like, I think for me, it's just always been about finding other people to share that with and getting solace in that. Yeah. And, you know, my biggest fear, and it's, you know, I finished the book in January, and it's an even bigger fear now, is that we are losing so many of those communal spaces. We are losing community centres. We are losing pubs. We are losing, like, libraries. We are just losing any place where, like, those ideas can kind of stem. And, like, that for me is, and I don't just want that to just go onto the internet. Like, it has to be IRL, so to speak, like real life stuff. And like, yeah, I guess it's a bit like, you know, I think that I'm going to try to write something when the book comes out that's a bit like how to find a shoulder to cry on that's 2 meters away. You know, all of the sort of sentiments are very much involve intimacy. But I'm like, there's got to be a way of, like, of doing it in these times for however long we're going to be like this. Because...
You see, I mean, the guide to these kind of things is kind of the perfect place to wrap this up on. Because, I mean, I've not read the book yet. We've just talked about it for ages, but I'm looking forward to reading it. But
it's coming to you first class post, baby.
I love it. On one of the bits of tips, it says one of the sections is how to help a loved one accept their sexuality. And it jumped out to me because it's something I want to read, because you're going to be completely unaware of this. You sprung an unawareness on me of, I didn't know I'd come to had this conversation and it influenced you and your mate Ollie and all this. But one of my, I still see as one of my greatest failings as an interviewer, was in early days of interviewing people, and it was with you. And I felt I fucked up massively, because it was at Bestival. And thankfully, I fucked up even more because the recordings didn't even work. But I was chatting to loads of people on the spoken word tent, and I just jumped straight in asking you about being a gay man, and all this kind of thing. And you kind of said to me at the time, you were like, I've not really figured out everything about my sexuality yet. And I felt really, it really made me realise that just because sexuality isn't something I've had to put a lot of consideration into, because my sexuality is the norm, I then felt, oh, I can, and because I'm, you know, I've got loads of gay mates, all this, it's not a big deal. It didn't occur to me that we don't really know each other, and I'm just jumping straight in. So, what's it like? And you were at that point still figuring things out. So, yeah, that's kind of stuck with me, that it's something that I should have been more aware of how to broach these subjects and whether to broach these subjects, I guess.
I mean, look, I had completely forgotten about it. It was a real trauma. No, I'm joking. No, but I mean, I think, yeah, but do you know what? I think, it does take a long time. And I think, you know, it's trying to, do you know, it's actually the one area of the book that I slightly worry that I have made it too sort of like gay male, if that makes sense. Right, I wish that I had maybe consulted some more of my friends about it. I think it's broad enough, but like, I would definitely say that, you know, because it's so nuanced and it is, there are so many different, you know, sexuality is a spectrum in my mind. And so it is kind of ever evolving, and it does sort of change quite a lot. But for me, I guess it's this sort of like, it's, there's just certain ways that we can be a little bit more, I don't know, like, I still think there's lots of friends of mine now who are straight, who would say to me stuff, or who had said to me, like, oh, we always knew, as, and you're sort of a bit like, well, I didn't, so, like, shut up.
Yeah.
I might have had an inkling, but, like, you know, it doesn't, it's not as simple as like, oh, I like the Spice Girls. It's not as simple as like, oh, I'm a bit effeminate. I like it's much more complex than that. And actually,
you always knew because of things that are completely unrelated to what was actually going on. You always knew because of your ignorance, not because of your wisdom, because of your ignorance.
But I definitely think, like, you know, there's a big bit in the book where I speak a lot about internalized homophobia and the many men that I have met in particular in a kind of dating or romantic capacity that are completely consumed with it, and how, and both how sad it is, but also how, like, I just can't be around it. Like, yeah. There comes a point where you've accepted yourself and your tolerance for that is very low, because you're a bit like, it's infectious, that sort of inner hatred. Yeah. If you start going down that path again, then you will just become it, you know? Mm. And it's stuff that sometimes even I've probably done what you did. I've probably done it to people all the time now, because I'm now reached a place where I'm much more comfortable. And you do slightly forget that it's not always like that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, I mean, for me, it's just, it's really about, like, listening. And it's about, like, not really making any kind of judgments on how it might turn out. Don't see it as like a finite thing, because it can change. I mean, I've known plenty of people that have got to like 34 and gone, I'm gay, and like, I'm like, great. Like, I think it's just one of those things that it's kind of ever evolving, and the more that we try to see it like that, the better, almost.
I remember talking to a mutual friend of ours who he had been out for a good while. And on a night out, he met a girl, and he found it harder to come out as bi, I guess, rather than just gay.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was like, oh, God, it had been such a big deal and such a big part of my identity to be gay. How can I now be dating a girl and being attracted to her and everything? And that was as much of a struggle. But it is that greater awareness that it is a fluid thing. And
100%.
Again, the kind of... the common thing out there that there's no such thing as a bi man and no such thing as a gay woman is that, like, society will believe that if you're a man and you're into men, you're gay.
Yeah.
I don't care about bi, you're gay. If you're a woman, you know, you probably like a bit of both and all this. If you're a man, no, you're definitely gay.
Yeah.
It's
just horrible, bizarre, like, threatening sort of like remnants of horrible patriarchy type thing where we're just like, well, if you fancy men, then get away from me.
Sexuality is defined on the person's relationship with penises rather than anything else.
I mean, I think what I would really hope as well is that the book has that. I think the main three themes of it are probably sexuality, mental health, and grief. Yeah. And I hope that you could read it as somebody completely...
But again, it's fun.
Yeah, but again, it's fun. It's really, it's honestly, guys, it's a cheeky ride.
I was excited to have you on the podcast, because I knew that we could speak on these heavy subjects for 90 minutes and it not... I don't feel that you've been depressing at all. I think this has been a fun listen.
So yeah, I think
that's an illustration of what the book is. It's
there's also some great tips on just like how to go to your first gay club, how to have a good time, make friends with a bouncer, like pretend you smoke because the most exciting stories happen in the smoking area. Bring your inhaler if you need it. but like, I think it's the sort of book where if you've lived through those experiences, then you're gonna find it funny and you're going to sort of relate to it. But if you haven't at all, then I hope it like leaves you feeling with actual tangible tips and advice and like a kind of like way of kind of approaching those things if they do ever come up in your life. So yeah, that's how I've reasoned with myself for writing a potentially very self-indulgent memoir.
I love it. Well, that's the perfect place to end on. Cheer the fuck up. How to Save Your Best Friend is either available to pre-order now or out now, depending on when people listen to this. So, yeah, I'm excited to read it. And thank you for coming on and having a chat. I love when these ones just come along naturally rather than I'm going through PR people and all this. But we were just chatting. I was like, well, shall we do the podcast next week? Yeah, all right.
I'm sort of a bit scared for you if you do read the book. There is no pressure to read it now, by the way.
Oh,
I was slightly scared because you do feature throughout it. I'd like to think of you potentially as like a kind of sort of orbiting guardian that's going to come in and out. If you could just find me a boyfriend now, that'd be great.
On it. I'll do my best. I'd love it if this podcast caused you to, someone heard this and got in touch and that became your long-term partner and I can continue to be this unknowing influence on your life. Well, thank you very much. It's been a bloody pleasure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Jack Rook. I kept the intro and the outro brief because we had a good old chat and we got comfortably over an hour. We could have gone for twice as long, it felt like. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I think Jack's fantastic. And I hope you all shout about this conversation because I really enjoyed it. It felt like an important one. I think the more people that hear this, the better. And the more people that get Jack's book, cheer the fuck up, the better as well. I'll be back next week with more more wonderful chatter. I've got so many good guests coming at the moment. I rushed this one out. I've got a few more in the chamber ready to fire. But this one, because of the timing of the book coming out and all that, I snuck out nice and quickly. So yeah, I'll see you next week on the Distraction Pieces podcast. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.